podcast.
Verbal violence. A first approximation based on Latin American migrants' experiences in German institutions. A text by Silke Jansen and Lucia Romero Gibu. 1. Introduction. A woman gets injured from a fall at the train station and is urged later to sign a hospital release written in a language she does not understand. She is not allowed to contact her relative, who must stay in the waiting room. A man is requested by a police officer to take off his jacket in winter and to answer questions in the street while freezing, with the only justification that he looks, quote, suspicious, unquote. A student is threatened by the secretary of a university department that she would tear up her contract because the mistake she made is, quote, not acceptable in the country where she lives now, unquote. These scenes, which were reported by Latin Americans who reside in Germany, illustrate a facet of a migrant's daily experience that has rarely been studied by linguists. Problematic communication events that arise in situations of unequal distribution of power, through the attribution of negative features to someone whose otherness is constructed and highlighted undirectionally during the encounter. Although the migrants clearly perceive the communicative behavior of their interlocutors as harming, and hence as a form of violence or aggression, its non-physical character and linguistic implicitness increase its potential to be tolerated by the participants or bystanders. These three examples are part of a corpus of critical communication incidents composed through semi-structured interviews within the project Violence in Institutions, VILIN, an integrated linguistic, politological, and psychological approach to the experiences and mental health of refugees and migrants, which started in May 2019 at Friedrich Alexander University of Erlangen-Nürnberg. VILIN seeks to focus attention on hidden forms of violence against migrants that may affect their well-being and health, but are particularly difficult to detect, document, and study, given that they are not carried out by physical force but through language, and usually behind the walls of public institutions. Designed as an interdisciplinary project, VILIN aims at A. Documenting migrants' experiences of verbal interactions with representatives of German institutions. B. Understanding how violences emerge from overt and covert linguistic strategies. C. Determining typical settings of verbal violence and its prevalence within different kinds of institutions and migrant groups. D. Studying the biological responses of people facing acts of verbal violence. And E. Identifying possible health risks related to a constant exposure to those kinds of stressful situations. The ultimate goal is to help enhance the quality of communication in institutions by developing recommendations that are empirically grounded and practicable according to intercultural competence criteria. Although the interplay between language and violence in the context of migration has generated an increasing amount of interest among researchers, most papers in linguistics have focused on analyzing hate speech or polemical debates in online and print media from a critical discourse analysis perspective. Manifestations of violence in direct or mediated interactions between representatives of institutions and migrants have been less studied so far. The present contribution offers some theoretical and methodological considerations regarding verbal violence and makes a first attempt at applying them to the linguistic data gathered within VILIN. Section 2 discusses some theoretical aspects of violence, language, and communication within institutions. In Section 3, we present the methodological framework used within VILIN for collecting and analyzing data. In Section 4, we propose a detailed analysis of an incident reported by one of our informants. In Section 5, we provide some conclusions. 2. Theoretical framework. Verbal violence, speech act theory, and institutional communication. 2.1. Verbal violence. Although the most visible form of violence is that inflicted by physical force, researchers have pointed out that the concept of violence should not be restricted to physical aggression alone, but should include any kind of behavior against individuals or groups that has negative consequences for the target's physical and mental integrity and health. According to the nature of the entity from which it originates, individual or interpersonal, institutional, as well as structural forms of violence can be distinguished. In the present contribution, we focus on language as an instrument of violence in face-to-face interactions prioritizing the individual and interpersonal dimension of the phenomenon. In analogy to other forms of violence, verbal violence can be understood as linguistic behavior that has detrimental effects on the interlocutor. However, the damage caused by words is not primarily physical, although psychobiological reactions can actually be triggered by verbal behavior, but rather affects the concerned person's positive self-identity. Following Goffman, we refer to the public self-identity of individuals as face, defined as, quote, the positive social value a person effectively claims for himself by the line others assume he has taken during a particular contact, unquote. That is, quote, an image of self delineated in terms of approved social attributes, unquote. Normally, participants in an interaction cooperatively engage in, quote, face work, unquote, showing consideration of the feelings and desires of their interlocutors. Against this backdrop, verbal aggression is the intentional use of linguistic strategies to damage the interlocutor's face wants, with the aim of causing psychological harm. In this respect, there is a certain degree of overlap between verbal aggression or violence and linguistic impoliteness, defined by Culpepper as the communication by the speaker or the perception by the hearer of an intentional face attack. However, we are reluctant to consider cases such as those mentioned in the introduction as mere impoliteness, given the power divide between the interlocutors and the relatively serious consequences. Especially in contexts of migration, verbal violence seems to be directly related to the construction of in- and out-groups, the negotiation and affirmation of positions of power, as well as negative stereotyping and denigration of individuals or social groups. Social processes that have been analyzed under the notion of discrimination. The exclusion of discriminated individuals has even been characterized as a canonical manifestation of violence. In line with these observations and summarizing previous research, Bonacci states that recurrent components of verbal violence and aggression include expressing negative feelings and attitudes towards the other interlocutor, for example, insulting him or her, and exercising power and control over the other interlocutor by reducing his or her interactional scope. Obviously, these practices are inherently face damaging. However, it's often difficult to decide whether a verbal attack has taken place or not. The aggressive potential of an utterance can be concealed behind a neutral or even a supportive surface structure, or vice versa. For example, in the case of mock impoliteness, sarcasm and irony, or when aggressive speech acts such as threats or insults are disguised as simple descriptions or observations. Therefore, both the speaker's and the hearer's perspective, as well as the communicative setting, in the broadest sense, must be considered in order to get a deeper understanding of the phenomenon. Speech act theory, short SAT, provides a useful way to theorize about the potentially violent force of language and its real-world effects. 2.2. Speech acts. Different methodological approaches have highlighted the performative character of violence exercised upon people through words. Using language, speakers do not only describe but actually perform actions, so that an utterance can be an act of violence in itself. Speech act theory provides a useful framework not only for understanding the performative dimension of linguistic behavior, but also the changing and ambiguous functions of utterances in social life. According to Searle, speech acts can be analyzed on four different levels. At a basic level, speakers produce acceptable sentences according to the norms of their language, relying on their linguistic knowledge. In other words, an utterance is made in line with the boundaries of grammaticality and the options available in the lexicon. At a second level, this utterance is a propositional act insofar as it is related to something in the world, for example, through reference or predication. At a third level, the utterance can be interpreted as an intentional verbal action, also called illocutionary act, according to the communicative conventions of the speech community. Finally, the utterance constitutes a prolocutionary act in that it causes certain effects on the listener, may they be intended or not. In summary, when someone says something, different acts are being performed at the same time. The propositional, the elocutionary, and the perlocutionary acts are neither totally independent from each other, nor do they emerge from one another in a mechanistic way. In addition, various elocutionary acts may be performed with the same utterance, so that participants must rely on different kinds of contextualization cues in order to infer the communicative function of an utterance. In relation to indirect speech acts, Searle states that, quote, a sentence that contains the elocutionary force indicators for one kind of elocutionary act can be uttered to perform, in addition, another type of elocutionary act, unquote. For example, the propositional content of the sentence in Spanish, ella no es de Bayern, she doesn't come from Bayern, ascribes an attribute, to be born outside Bavaria, to a female person. On the surface level, the elocutionary act carried out is that of informing. However, the informant, who relayed the situation from which the sentence was taken, interpreted it as an indirect speech act with an aggressive elocutionary force. She reported that the doctor who treated her after an accident said it to another member of the medical staff, in a harsh tone, and after complaining about her incapacity to speak German properly. Against this backdrop, she inferred that the doctor's intention was not only to inform his colleague about the patient's origin, but also to commit an act of exclusion, which she experienced as aggressive. In the interview, she describes the perlocutionary effects of this speech act as emotional distress, which had negative consequences for the further development of the experience because she was unable to find appropriate assistance and signed her own discharge although she was still injured. In this case, like in many others from our corpus, an aggressive elocutionary force is not directly manifested on the surface level, and the alleged, quote, aggressor, unquote, could easily disclaim any harmful intentions. Whether or not the damage was intended, the informant clearly experiences the utterance's violence. Several authors have pointed out that that perception seems to be the crucial element in the identification of violence. In this line of thinking, Havrilev makes the distinction between verbal aggression and verbal violence. A speech act can be called aggressive when the speaker has the intention to harm the interlocutor and selects linguistic strategies in order to achieve this goal. Verbal violence occurs when a speech act causes negative effects on the well-being of the addressee, independent of whether the utterer was aware of the damaging potential of the act or not. Thus, verbal aggression is defined in accordance with the intended elocutionary force of a verbal attack, while verbal violence depends on the actual perlocutionary effect. Under the migrant-centered perspective adopted in the Vilnius project, we focus on interactions that informants report to have affected them in a negative way, and therefore fall under the category of verbal violence. Verbal aggression may or may not be involved, and in most cases of perceived violence without overtly marked aggression, it is impossible to verify whether or not the speaker actually intended to hurt his or her interlocutor. However, by collecting and analyzing critical incidents reported by migrants, we aim at detecting features of verbal interactions in institutional contexts to which they systematically attribute a harmful effect, and to identify the typical elocutionary forces that the interviewees assign to the utterances of their counterparts in problematic encounters, as well as the perlocutionary effects most commonly described. For the time being, we assume that covert verbal violence emerges from a complex interplay between the linguistic structure of the utterance, the interlocutor's expectations and implicit knowledge regarding the interaction, and different extralinguistic factors that guide the interpretation of the situation. Among these are the typical characteristics of institutional communication, which will be presented in the following section. 2.3. Institutional communication. The violent potential of utterances doesn't emerge from linguistic choices alone. When attributing, aggressive or other, elocutions to utterances, speakers rely on co-text, context, and background knowledge in a complex way, and they evaluate their interlocutor's verbal behavior against their communicative expectations from previous experience. Thus, the same speech act may be interpreted differently and cause different perlocutionary effects depending on extralinguistic factors. The particular conditions of communication within institutions thus cannot be neglected when it comes to examining how verbal violence arises in interaction between migrants and institutional agents. Formalized interaction scripts and different kinds of asymmetries between participants have been highlighted as core characteristics of institutional communication. Interactions in institutions generally have a precise purpose, which is embedded in a broader institutional, administrative, or societal matrix. Roles of participants are fixed, and the development of the conversation follows a formalized interactional script in order to guarantee efficiency in communication. For example, many institutional scripts contain a data interrogation sequence where the representative asks a given number of questions about personal information in a given order, and the client is expected to answer them. Thus, topic development, turn-taking behavior, speech act types, and other characteristics of the interaction are largely predetermined. Awareness of the interactional script related to a particular procedure is part of the background knowledge that guides the interlocutor's behavior and mutual interpretations. Deviations from interactional expectations may serve as contextualization cues, for example, to infer illocutions that are not overtly expressed. When engaging in an institutional interaction, representatives and clients endorse different but complementary roles, characterized by different kinds of symmetries. Quote, institutional interactions may be characterized by role-structured, institutionalized, and omnirelevant asymmetries between participants in terms of such matters as differential distribution of knowledge, rights to knowledge, access to conversational resources, and to participation in the interaction. In ordinary conversation between friends and acquaintances, by contrast, this is not normally the case. Unquote. Differences in knowledge may relate to information about institutional structures, procedures and routines, but also to cultural background and linguistic resources. Given that institutional interactions with migrants are generally also intercultural encounters, misunderstandings and conflicts may arise from asymmetrical language resources and divergent expectations for communicative behavior and from false assumptions about the body of knowledge shared by the interlocutors. In contrast to other contexts where speakers are free to engage in a conversation or to break it off, institutional communication is compulsory by nature, and refusal to cooperate may trigger sanctions. The formalized nature of institutional interaction scripts reduces the array of possibilities for action available to participants, with different degrees according to different types of institutions. This is not to say, however, that the client's role in institutional interactions is only passive. Indeed, clients may challenge institutional hierarchies and asymmetries and show provocative or even aggressive verbal behavior. That being said, the reduction of interactional scope mentioned by Bonacci as one of the core components of verbal violence appears thus to a certain degree as an inherent feature of institutional communication. Indeed, power asymmetries between interlocutors have been reported to play a key role in the emergence of verbal violence. However, it should be made clear that the compulsory character of institutional communication and the client's reduced possibilities for verbal action cannot, per se, be considered as verbal violence. Rather, they are a manifestation of the regulating function of institutional power in the interactional field. For the purpose of Veelin, we propose to restrict the concept of verbal violence to the interpersonal level, that means to verbal exchanges between individuals that are experienced as harmful for the positive self-concept or face of at least one of the participants. In our project, we make a first attempt at empirically documenting cases of perceived interpersonal violence between migrants and representatives of German institutions with a critical incident technique, which will be presented in the next section along with methodological issues. 3. Methodological framework. 3.1. Empirical approaches to verbal violence against migrants, the critical incident technique. The collection of empirical data about interactions with the violent component in institutions leads to a number of methodological difficulties. First, considerations of data protection and a certain discomfort about giving researchers access into internal processes might lead to reluctancy among institutions and their representatives to allow recordings. Secondly, verbal violence functions in such a way that even the affected people usually have doubts about whether what they experienced was really an act of aggression or violence. As a first approximation to the phenomenon, we collect narratives of, quote, unpleasant, unquote, interactions among migrants from Latin America living in Germany with the critical incident technique, short CIT. CIT was developed in the context of the aviation psychology program of the United States Army Air Forces in the Second World War. At that time, critical incidents with positive and negative outcomes in aviation were collected and analyzed in order to determine which abilities were required to be a good pilot. Since then, CIT has been extensively used in social and communicative sciences, especially intercultural communication, as an ex post procedure to gather data on events where people showed some kind of behavior which led to positive or negative outcomes, whose appearance is unpredictable and which have far-reaching and long-lasting consequences. Within the Violent Project, we collect reports on negative experiences in verbal interactions with representatives of German institutions, using a narrative stimulus and a semi-structured guideline, the Violent SIT. Our corpus, which is not yet completed, currently consists of 49 individual interviews in Spanish language obtained with Violent SIT. As of April 2020, 32 of them have been transcribed with ELIN, version 5.5, organized with ARPIL, version 2.6.1109, using Clarin resources, and partially coded with MexQDA, version 2018. The participants are citizens from Latin American countries who reside in Germany and speak Spanish as their first language. The interviews were conducted by students from the master programs The Americas, Las Americas, and Linguistics at FAU, who were native or highly proficient speakers of Spanish and had some familiarity with the topic of our study for biographical and or academic reasons. The interviews were conducted individually, and the interviewers took great care to create an atmosphere of confidence and relaxed openness so that participants felt comfortable to narrate their experiences. In the specialized literature on communication between migrants and representatives of institutions of the receiving society, quote, authentic, unquote, data, that means recordings of direct interactions, are usually considered to be the most valuable empirical basis. Sometimes recordings are also triangulated with interviews or questionnaires with both parties in order to enhance the objectivity of the data. However, this approach was infeasible for the present study, as institutions are not likely to open their doors to researchers documenting verbal violence against migrants. In contrast to the studies mentioned before, the material gathered with VLIN with the CIT consists of narratives of personal experience that are highly subjective recreations of past events, rather than objective representations of them. The open-ended character of our interviews, together with the spatial and temporal distance between the interview situation and the recounted incident, contributes further to the subjective character of the material. However, under the migrant-centered framework proposed here, this subjectivity is not only tolerated, but intended. If, as we explained before, verbal violence emerges from the speaker's reaction to his or her interlocutor's behavior based on subjective interpretation, then a first analytical approximation to the phenomenon should start from the affected person's perception. As we have shown in Section 2, verbal violence, especially in its covert manifestation, cannot be directly observed in interactions, but must always be inferred by the analyst from linguistic and other behavior. In contrast to recordings, the narratives produced by migrants provide first-hand information on attributed illocutions and on perlocutionary effects, as well as on components of co-text, context, and background knowledge that led to those interpretations and emotional reactions. Through the narrative construction, those pieces of information are integrated by the informants into an organized whole of experience. Collecting them allows us to examine how perceived verbal violence emerges from making sense of a complex interplay of linguistic and contextual phenomena that guide the interpretation of verbal interactions. It also makes it easier to avoid the common pitfall of SAT, which often confines the analysis to isolated speech acts with minimal context. Finally, further information frequently offered in the interviews, for example regarding migrant biographies, typical challenges with the adaptation process and migrants' reactions to them, comparisons between the homeland and Germany, values and attitudes at their arrival at present, etc., helps to reconstruct how the informants position themselves towards or within the receiving society and construct their face as migrants in Germany. In sum, narratives on critical incidents provided by migrants are neither more nor less authentic than recordings would be. They're just one way of capturing migrants' experience in Germany among other possible approaches. For the specific demands of our study, they provide an added value because they allow access to the involved person's perceptions and constructions of the incident, and thus to information that otherwise would only be inferred by the researcher from his or her point of view. In addition, common obstacles related to fieldwork in institutions can be avoided. In order to appropriately analyze autobiographical accounts, a narrative approach is needed. This approach will be outlined in the following section. 3.2. Analyzing accounts of critical incidents as narratives. As Labov and Waletsky state in a seminal text, narrative as, quote, one verbal technique for recapitulating experience, unquote, serves two fundamental functions, which they refer to as referential and evaluative. In line with this distinction, referential and evaluative components can be identified within a narrative. Referential components present the facts or events important to the development of the narrated incident, answering the question, what happened? Those facts are presented in a particular chronological order that cannot be reversed without changing the overall temporal interpretation. In evaluative segments, speakers give additional information on the implications and consequences of single facts or of the event as a whole for their personal needs, desires, and perceptions, answering the question, so what? Although priority should be given to the semantical considerations, referential and evaluative stretches of the narratives can be distinguished, at least to a certain extent, on structural grounds. For example, subordination or irrealist mood, in narratives produced in English language, can be interpreted as indications that a clause is evaluative. By grammatically distinguishing between events that are temporally bounded or unbounded in the past, Romance languages have an additional structural device for distinguishing between facts that belong to a chain of events and descriptions of concomitant circumstances. In line with different approaches within Romance linguists that focus on the functioning of a spectral distinctions in discourse, we assume that referential information belonging to the chain of events tends to be coded in verbal forms that present events as temporally bounded, basically Spanish pretérito perfecto simple, and evaluative information in verbal forms that present events as temporally unbounded, basically Spanish imperfecto, but also present tense. As for the overall structural organization, narratives generally begin with an orientation, providing information on time, place, participants, and other circumstances of the event. This is followed by the description of the complicating action, with its complications and resolutions. Finally, narratives often end with a coda, a statement that captures in a nutshell the point of the whole narrative and connects it to the present moment. The co-presence and interaction of referential and evaluative components makes personal narratives a particularly promising text genre for the analysis of verbal violence. Given that our interviews focus on communicative experiences, many narratives are centered around what different participants said or asked at certain points of the event. Thus, the referential part of the narrative is often a description of an interactional sequence with its surrounding circumstances. In the evaluative clauses and sections, however, informants explain how they interpret their interlocutor's verbal and nonverbal behavior and express their feelings and emotional reactions to it. The key to constructing what triggered the informant's perception of verbal violence lies in the mutual references and dependencies between referential and evaluative statements in the narratives. In the following case study of one exemplary critical incident from our corpus, we make a first attempt at combining SAT with Labov and Valetsky's model for narrative analysis in order to gain insights into the emergence of verbal violence in institutional contexts. 4. Sample analysis. Police control at the train. In the following, we offer a verbal transcription of a critical incident reported by a participant from Central America. We reproduce the original version in Spanish with its translation to English.
English translation. Well, let's say a very awful incident was a security control that I had in a train. I was on my way to Switzerland for a job interview. Let's say that of all the people in the train car, I wasn't the only foreigner, but I was the only foreigner with dark skin, you know? I mean, I do remember that very well. There were, I don't know if they were Chinese, Japanese, or Korean, but there were, let's say, Asian people. And the migratory crisis had just occurred, you know? And obviously it was normal that there were more controls, you know? What surprised me was that first the train was going to Switzerland and not from Switzerland to Germany, where there were the greatest number of controls, or from Italy to Switzerland. But the trip was from Germany to Switzerland. So let's say I was a little confused why there were controls in this direction. Second, this was a very blatant thing on the part of the officers because I was sitting reading a book. I wasn't doing anything that could have made me look suspicious, or anything that anybody that could have disturbed anybody. And three police officers arrived, they stood in front of me and began to ask what I was doing in this train, where I was going, why I was going to Switzerland, why I wanted to work in Switzerland, and all that even though they weren't officers from the Swiss police, but from the German police, you know. So let's say, I don't know, you know? Like, I didn't understand why there was so much interest in what I was going to do in Switzerland. I mean, look, it's just like, well, he's leaving Germany. Well, okay, bye, isn't it? But I realized that this really wasn't a routine check, because it wasn't either so like if they were very thoughtful when checking documents. Because in general, when they ask you for your identification document, they even call a central department, where they ask for the corroboration of the personal info and so on. They just asked me to show my identification document. They just looked at it, they asked me what I was doing in the train, where I was going, what I was doing in Germany, and I explained to them that I was studying, and that I was going to a job interview for an internship to do my bachelor thesis. And they asked me what I had inside my bag, that, let's say, was in the luggage rack above the seats. And I said that I was only carrying the clothes I was going to wear, you know, because there was practically nothing else in there. And they asked me this question like two or three times, until I said, you know what, do you want me to open the suitcase for you? And then they noticed that I was beginning to get upset, because I realized that this wasn't a routine control, you know, but that it was happening to me just because I was a foreigner, you know. I mean, it's something you notice because of the tone, you know, because it wasn't a tone like, well, what are you doing here and there? You realize that the tone was a little more rude, and progressively I noticed that they didn't even had interest in calling to check the personal info or anything, but they were just giving me a hard time during the check, you know. When they noticed that I also showed discomfort, then they decided to leave. They gave me my documents back. Like I say, also I repeat, they never called to check the personal info, and they left, and they didn't check anyone else in the train car, you know. Then I got a little confused, upset obviously, and one of the other passengers who was there just turned around, you know. He said on the other side. Not on the other side of the train, but we were on the seats of the left. He was in exactly the same position as me, but on the right-hand side. He turned around, t- talked to me and said that he was very sorry that I had to deal with this, you know, that I shouldn't take it too personally. And I said, but of course, you try not to take it personally. But in the end, because it isn't a routine control, you realize that what they are implicitly telling you is, you don't belong here, you know? The narrated episode falls under the interactional script Police Control, which is strongly shaped by the conditions of institutional communication. The narrative contains an orientation, lines 1 to 25, the narration of the incident proper, lines 26 to 77, and the coda, lines 78 to 92. Referential and evaluative components are spread throughout the text. The first lines of the orientation frame the narrated incident as problematic, muy feo, very awful, line 1. Provide general information about the interactional script, police control, the setting, train, line 2, and the narrator's situation and motives, trip to Switzerland for job interview, line 3. Section 4 to 11 contains a description of the general situation and it is, at the same time, revealing with regard to the way how the informant constructs his face as a migrant in Germany. In lines 4 to 9, he categorizes himself as a foreigner, positioning himself against both German, mainstream society and other migrant groups because of his dark skin color. Although it is not obvious at this point why he gives this information, we can infer from Grice's maxim of relation that it is relevant. In line 10, the informant provides a description of the temporal and political juncture of that time, migration crisis in Germany, and recognizes the necessity of routine police controls against this backdrop, line 11, which may be interpreted as an expression of his fundamental understanding of the situation and his general willingness to cooperate with German institutions as another facet of his faith. This aspect will be further elaborated on and reinforced in the course of the narration. Next, two perlocutionary effects are presented as referential facts, experiencing surprise in line 12 and confusion in line 18, and some evaluative information is provided about the reasons for these reactions, unexpected time and place of the control, lines 13 to 18. The referential statement that the agent's behavior was blatant, line 20, is evaluated against the description of the informant's activities immediately before the control. He was reading comfortably and doing nothing that could have made him suspicious or disruptive to other passengers, lines 22 to 25. At the same time, it may be read as an anticipation and overall evaluation of the policeman's conduct. This section further supports the informant's self-identity as a normal, well-educated, and inoffensive person. The arrival of the policeman, line 26, marks the beginning of the problematic encounter. Although it is not explicitly stated, the hearer can infer from previously given information that the informant was selected for control because of his skin color. That means because of what he considers to be a visible difference from other people in the train and from the non-migrant people in Germany. The narrative comes back to this point at the end of the complicating action, line 60. The description of the complicating action starts in line 26. The referential framework of this part is made up nearly exclusively by only two types of verbal exemes. Speech act verbs, such as cuestionar, to question, line 28, preguntar, hacer una pregunta, to ask a question, lines 47, 52, and 56, pedir, to ask for, line 45, explicar, explain, line 49, and decir, say, lines 54 and 57, as well as verbs that describe mental states and processes, among them darse cuenta, to realize, lines 58, 59, 64, and 65, molestarse, mostrar molestia, to get angry, show anger, lines 58 and 69, ver, see, understand, line 68, and quedarse confundido, molesto, to become confused, angry, lines 76 to 77. The events these words refer to form a chain of action which functions as the referential skeleton of the narrative. What happened? They are in temporal juncture and cannot be reversed, because each one triggers the next one. Compare also the frequent use of agency pairs such as me preguntaron, they asked me, and les expliqué, I explained to them. Me preguntaron, they asked me, and y les dije, and I told them, etc. Embedded within this structure, we find quotations of the interlocutor's utterances, or propositions, in direct, lines 38 and 57, or indirect, lines 29 to 32, 47 to 48, and 52, speech, which elaborate the verbal actions expressed in the speech act verbs. The interrogatives, que, por qué, and subordinating conjunctions, que, used in these sequences support the elocutions expressed in the verb of the independent clause, that means asking for and providing information. Thus, the complicating action is presented as a sequence of questions, answers, and cognitive and emotional responses to those speech acts. In other words, a succession of verbal actions, elocutions, and their consequences, perlocutionary effects. Interestingly, despite their allegedly subjective character, the perlocutionary effects are presented by the informant as integral elements of the development of the action, on equal terms with the more objectively observable behavioral aspects of the situation. At this point, we can already conclude from the referential structure and content of the incident that it falls under the category of verbal violence, because the perlocutionary effects that are reported to emerge from the verbal behavior, confusion, anger, harm the informant's well-being. However, we cannot say how or why they emerge without considering the evaluative information. So what? The evaluative segments in line 33 to 38, 40 to 44, and 60 to 67 describe different kinds of circumstances of the incident, as well as the narrator's inferences from them. They turn the enumeration of events into a coherent narrative by establishing conceptual links between the different kinds of verbal actions, elocutive acts, and their cognitive and emotional consequences, perlocutionary effects. It is this very information that helps us to understand why the informant experiences the interaction as an instance of verbal violence. In the referential section in lines 26 to 32, the narrator reports the arrival of the policeman and the beginning of the questioning. These referential facts are evaluated in line 33 to 38, where the narrator marks them as something unusual. ¿Y eso qué? Line 33. Coming back to his previous statement, lines 13 to 17, according to which the time and place of the control did not make sense within a normal police control, because there were enhanced controls of people entering Germany, but not leaving the country. This reflection leads him to the conclusion that the control was not a routine procedure, line 39. In the following evaluative section, lines 40 to 44, the narrator gives more reasons for this interpretation by contrasting the incident with his previous experience with police controls in Germany. According to him, the officers normally ask for the identification document and call an agency in order to obtain confirmation of the migrant's identity and legal status, but this time there is no telephone call. Against this backdrop, the informant evaluates the agent's behavior as inadequate and careless. Line 40. From line 45 onwards, the informant returns to his referential description. The further development of the interaction is described as a succession of directive speech acts and responses to them. Asking for, presentation and checking of identification document in line 45 and 46, questions and answers regarding the informant's destination and plans in lines 47 to 51, and repeated questions about the content of the informant's suitcase in lines 52 to 56. The informant's offer to open the suitcase, line 57, comes as the culmination of the complicating action, which triggers a reaction that finally leads to the solution. Having noticed his anger, the policemen leave, lines 68 and following. Although on the surface level the informant is uttering a commissive speech act, the discourse marker saben qué, you know what, and the description of the perlocutionary effect of this speech act on the agents, Ya se dieron cuenta que me empecé a molestar, and they noticed that I was beginning to get upset, line 58, suggests that this utterance may actually be interpreted as an expressive speech act, expressing disapproval about the policeman's behavior, with a certain degree of aggression. This is the only moment within the narrative of the control when the informant speaks out and takes the initiative, instead of just reacting to the policeman. Thus, this important turning point in the narrative is also presented as a moment of personal empowerment for the informant. It is an act of, quote, subversive rebellion, unquote, which momentarily suspends the power asymmetries between participants and probably serves as an outlet for the frustration and aggression the informant has accumulated up to this point. His renewed statement that the control was not routine, line 59, refers back to line 39, but this time it is used as a justification for his reaction, rather than a conclusion from the policeman's behavior. What follows is a sequence of evaluative information where the narrator insists once more that the control was abnormal because the officers did not make the expected telephone call, line 66. Then he goes one step further in his interpretation. Having made clear that the interactions are not in line with his expectations regarding the interactional script police control, and that the agents were not interested in his identity or legal status, he rejects the surface illocutions of the agents' questions. As he must assume that their behavior is intentional according to Grice's relevance principle, he infers that the policeman's questions are only a camouflage for verbal aggression. Against this background, he concludes that the perlocutionary effect he is experiencing, anger, confusion, is actually intended by his interlocutors. La intención era simplemente hacerme pasar un mal rato durante el control, ¿verdad? The intention was only to give me a hard time during the control, you know? Line 67. Prosodic features of the policeman's utterances are highlighted as an additional clue which guided him towards this interpretation. Tono pesado, rude tone, line 61 to 64. Taking up an element already mentioned in the orientation, the narrator assumes racism as a motive for the allegedly regressive behavior of the policeman, line 60. The presentation of the incident proper ends with the referential description of the policeman giving him his papers back and leaving, line 68 to 74. In a kind of closing section, two elements that appeared earlier as evaluative information are elevated to the status of referential facts. They're used in Pretérito Perfecto Simple. The narrator re-emphasizes that the policeman definitely did not make a phone call, line 73, and that they definitely did not control anybody else in the train car but him, line 75. This leaves him again confused and angry, line 76 to 77. The coda begins with line 78. In a kind of addendum, the narrator relates another passenger's reaction to the scene and draws a general conclusion from the incident. The referential parts of this section describe how a witness of the police control turns around to him and expresses his regret about the behavior of the agents, recommending him not to take it too personally, line 78 to 87. However, the informant takes a different view, lines 87 to 88. What follows in lines 89 to 92 is a kind of justification for his disagreement with the passenger, which is at the same time an overall evaluation of the incident. The informant highlights once more his fundamental willingness to accept the reduction of interactional scope that characterizes institutional communication, line 88, as one facet of his self-identity as a migrant. However, given that the interaction did not correspond to his expectations regarding the interactional script police control, line 90, he infers that the policemen were actually abusing their institutional power to commit an act of interpersonal aggression and violence against him. Unlike institutional violence that strikes regardless of the individual case, the agent's behavior is felt as a targeted attack against him as a person, although he had done nothing to deserve it. Compare the construction of his face as a cooperative, well-educated migrant in the orientation. The coda culminates in a fictional reformulation of the policeman's alleged verbal aggressions in terms of a direct speech act. Tú no perteneces acá. You don't belong here. line 92, which stands as a recapitulation of the whole incident. Thus, the elocution the informant assumes behind the policeman's questioning is actually an act of interpersonal offense and exclusion. In sum, the informant experiences the police control as an instance of covert aggression and verbal violence. The presence of verbal violence can be directly deduced from the referential organization of complicating action, which basically comes as a chain of references to the speech acts, together with their negative perlocutionary effects, confusion and anger. The evaluative parts provide information about the cues that led the narrator to infer covert aggressive elocutionary intentions from the overt elocution, asking for information, which explains the perlocutionary effects. Among them, he mentions racialized criteria for his selection for the control, its unusual time and place according to his previous knowledge, the discrepancy between the agent's verbal behavior and his expectations concerning the genre police control, especially the lack of the phone call and the questions for the motive of the journey and the content of the suitcase, as well as prosodic features of the agent's utterances. Against this backdrop, the incident is framed as a unique and personal case of intentional aggression and discrimination because of visible difference, not as a manifestation of blind institutional or structural violence. However, the institutional character of the interaction adds to the elocutionary force of the aggression, because it restrains the informant's possibilities for action due to the asymmetric and compulsory character of communication with an institutional interlocutors. For example, the informant cannot refuse to communicate with the policeman or act with overt aggression without risking sanctions, as he could do if one of the passengers started to attack him verbally. This is the reason why he also draws on covert verbal aggression at one point in the interaction, line 57. It's important to note that it's impossible to know if the interpersonal violence perceived by the informant was intended or not. For some of the contextual clues mentioned in the narrative, alternative interpretations could be envisaged. However, the aim of our analysis is not to reconstruct what the policeman really intended to do with their words, or to decide if the informant is right with his interpretation, but to gain insights into which salient linguistic and extra-linguistic cues guide migrants towards experiencing interactions as violent. 5. Conclusions. The present contribution is a first approximation to Latin American migrants' experiences with verbal violence in German institutions. Within the VLN project, we propose a migrant-centered approach based on personal accounts of problematic interactions in institutional contexts, critical incidents. These are analyzed combining speech act theory with narrative analysis in order to gain insights into how the perception of violence emerges from the interplay between linguistic features and contextual factors under the conditions of institutional communication. As our analysis of the incident police control at the border has shown, it's not primarily the inherent power asymmetries and the compulsory character of institutional communication which produce the perception of violence in the informant, but rather the feeling of being the target of an individual act of aggression, othering, and exclusion under the cloak of institutional needs. Thus, the institutional context does not produce verbal violence per se, but it adds to the face-damaging effects of the agent's behavior by significantly reducing the migrant's options for action, leaving him more vulnerable than in other possible scenarios. This particular experience seems to be consistent with the rest of our corpus. However, further investigation is needed to provide an overall picture of verbal violence against migrants in German institutions.